Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, one of your hosts for today, along with Ursula Rutenberg. Ursula, it is good to be with you again on a Monday.
It's good to be with you again, too, Mr. Hart.
You know that old saying or the old song from the Carpenters, rainy days and Mondays always get me down?
We got both.
We got both. Enough said, right?
Well, here's the weather. I almost feel ridiculous reading it. Okay, I'm just going to do it. Temperatures are going to be in the high 70s and 80s this week, and there are flash flood warnings for the state. Today, showers and thunderstorms likely. Chance of precipitation is 70%, and I think we're already seeing that
70%. I think it's 100%, yes.
The rainfall today and tonight is expected to be around an inch. Tuesday and Tuesday night, showers and thunderstorms likely around, I think they're thinking about another inch of rain. Mm. And then Wednesday and Wednesday night, more showers and thunderstorms, another inch of rain. Thursday and Thursday night is a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, which, believe it or not, is actually means maybe it won't rain or have storms that day.
Maybe.
And Friday, there's going to be a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms. We're going to have rain and thunderstorms pretty much through Friday. Well, I put my fern out, and it is very happy.
Yeah.
However, Friday night, no rain or thunderstorms are predicted.
Well, so you say. This sounds like an endless loop of storms coming in here. This is remarkable.
And finally, on Sunday, it should be sunny and warm, around 77. So that's it. Check your basements on a regular basis.
I know what this means, Ursula, is a lot of lawn mowing next weekend because the grass is growing so green and so tall, the noise will be emanating from all the neighborhoods in the community. Yeah. Well, let's start, as we always do on Monday, with a look at the week's news, this past week's news from the state of Iowa, and there was a lot of it. The death of Molly Tibbetts continued to make news all around the state. Among the stories, the man accused of killing the 20-year-old University of Iowa student has changed lawyers. Christian Rivera will now be represented by Chad and Jennifer Freese of Marshalltown. Rivera's new lawyers waived his right to a preliminary hearing, which had been set for last Friday. No new court date has been set for Rivera. Meanwhile, most of the money given to the reward fund to bring Molly Tibbetts home safely will be returned to those who contributed. Crime Stoppers said no reward will be paid to any individual providing information in the case because Molly was not, of course, safely returned. Some donations will be dispersed to the group's general fund or to the Tibbetts family. Meanwhile, Iowa 4th District Congressman Steve King made news by defending his previous calls for stricter immigration enforcement made after the death of Molly Tibbetts. King said violent crimes are carried out by undocumented immigrants every day. Authorities said Christian Rivera is an undocumented immigrant. King said it was his responsibility to protect all Americans and that he plans to continue raising the issue while Tibbetts' death is in the national news cycle. He said if his views on immigration were law, Tibbetts would not have been killed. At least one study from the Pew Research Center shows that immigrants commit fewer crimes in the United States than native-born Americans. Meanwhile, racist graffiti was spray-painted on a Des Moines street last week. It read, "Deport Illegals," and it was sprayed in red letters on Bloomfield Road. Des Moines work crews got rid of it within a couple of hours of its discovery. And the Des Moines Register reported that phone calls from a Brooklyn, Iowa number are using Molly Tibbetts' death to promote white nationalist messages. But those calls do not originate in Iowa. Instead, they were paid for by a neo-Nazi podcast linked to a man in Idaho. And Molly Tibbetts' father weighed in on all this with an op-ed piece in yesterday's Des Moines Register. Rob Tibbetts wrote that fomenting discord among races is a disgrace to our flag. He said Molly is not a pawn in others' debate. In his words, allow us to grieve in privacy and with dignity at long last. Show some decency. Also last week, authorities in LaPorte City confirmed that the remains found earlier this month were those of 16-year-old Jake Wilson, who had gone missing months ago. The teen's remains were found in Wolf Creek near his home. Cause of his death has not been determined, nor is there any answer yet as to why he disappeared. Jake told his parents last April 7th that he was going for a walk near the creek, and he never came back home. There was word last week that Iowa farmers could be helped by the announcement that the U.S. has reached a tentative trade deal with Mexico. State farmers are facing up to $2 billion in losses from the tariff wars that have broken out between the U.S. and other countries. Prices for soybeans, pork, corn, and other farm products went down in recent months. Back in July, President Trump announced $12 billion in emergency aid to farmers caught up in those trade battles. Last week, the president said Mexico had promised to start buying as many farm products as they can. Iowa State University economist Chad Hart said he hopes The pending trade deal with Mexico means a quick agreement is on the way with Canada, which is another top ag trading partner. Trump said the U.S. would start negotiating with Canada soon. Also last week, U.S. Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue showed up at the Farm Progress Show in Boone. He fielded questions about the tariff wars, but also took the opportunity to say that President Trump had told him he wants a proposal allowing year-round use of gasoline with E15. That's 15% ethanol. E15 is now banned during the summer because of worries about smog. Ethanol advocates say boosting year-round use of E15 would increase demand for ethanol and corn, which are, of course, widely used to make the fuel. Also last week, two men sued the Des Moines Police Department after they say officers racially profiled them. It allegedly took place during a traffic stop in July. During that stop, two officers accused the men of having drugs and a gun, but they were eventually released. The lawsuit alleges that police violated the men's civil rights. Meanwhile, the father of that two-year-old boy who shot and wounded himself with his parents' weapon earlier this month has now been charged. 29-year-old Jonathan Hauser faces a charge of child endangerment causing bodily injury. Authorities said Hauser left a loaded, unsecured .45-caliber handgun in a piece of luggage while his family was staying at an inn in Clive. The boy picked it up and pulled the trigger. He is recovering. There was also word that an eastern Iowa couple who kept hundreds of animals in their home had pleaded guilty to child endangerment. They received a deferred judgment of 2 years of supervised probation, and they must take part in parent, child, and mental health evaluations. This after police recovered about 700 living and dead animals from their home, where their four children also lived. Under the rules of their sentence, the couple can keep one dog, one fish, two cats, and six so-called small animals inside their Vinton home. Still on the court beat, an Iowa State University football player and another student have now been charged after ISU police received reports of possibly armed individuals on campus a couple of weeks ago. 18-year-old Dallas Taylor Cortez, a freshman defensive back, was charged with harassment. Tasiera Whitaker Wells, a sophomore majoring in early childhood education, was charged with filing a false report. This after police recovered multiple BB guns during the campus incident. Taylor Cortez is one of four freshmen on the football team who were suspended indefinitely for what Coach Matt Campbell called multiple incidents of poor choices and behavior. The federal government announced last week that it bought the former Riverfront YMCA property in Des Moines for $6.5 million. The government bought the land on Locust Street from Hubble Realty, which had planned to build a $75 million condominium development there. Instead, the government will build a new federal courthouse on that site at a cost of $137 million. Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said last week that he cannot foresee anything that would make him delay this week's Senate hearings on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Democrats have demanded that those hearings be postponed until more information is available about Kavanaugh's past. Grassley is chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which checks out the president's Supreme Court nominees before the full Senate considers them. Still on the political front, Iowa Democratic gubernatorial candidate Fred Hubble and his wife released a summary of their state and federal tax returns last week. It showed that they had more than $3 million income last year and paid $500,000 in state and federal taxes. Earlier, Hubble's opponent in the November election, Republican Governor Kim Reynolds, released 10 years of her and her husband's tax returns, showing, among other things, they earned about $163,000 last year and paid $28,000 in taxes. Also last week, Iowa's other Republican U.S. Senator, Joni Ernst, paid tribute to John McCain, the Arizona Republican senator who died at the age of 81. Ernst said McCain taught her how to be a senator, how to stand firm on her principles. And on a side note, there was word that Joni Ernst and her husband are getting a divorce. She and her husband, Gail, have been married for 25 years, and they have one daughter. There was an interesting what-if story that surfaced in Iowa on Friday, and it involved the Yonkers department store chain, which officially closed its doors last Wednesday. After that closure, the store's website posted a notice claiming that a comeback could be in the works. The exact wording on that website read, "Yonkers is coming back," and more information was said to be coming soon. But there were many doubters. One of them, the general manager of the Jordan Creek Town Center in West Des Moines, who was quoted as saying, "There's no way that can be real. As they say on TV, stay tuned." One of the big stories last week involved the events of last Saturday night, when lightning and heavy rain caused the cancellation of Iowa State University's season-opening football game against South Dakota State at Jack Trice Stadium. The game was halted 4 minutes and 5 seconds into the first quarter, and it never restarted. The game was recorded as a no contest. It was the first Iowa State game to be canceled in 55 years. The last time was back in 1963, on November 23rd to be exact, the day after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Iowa State was supposed to play Drake that day, but of course, it did not. There are no plans to reschedule Saturday night's game against South Dakota State, but Iowa State may try to schedule another team to play here on October 20th, which is supposed to be a bye week for ISU. Also last week, the amazing story about the amazing good luck an Ankeny man has just had. 54-year-old Gary West has just landed his second six-figure Iowa lottery prize in the past dozen years. West scratched off a $250,000 top prize after he bought a pair of tickets from a Casey's outlet. 12 years ago, West won a $100,000 scratch game prize. So what's he going to do with his latest newfound riches? Well, West says he plans to go shopping for a car. And one last note, and this has to do with the weather that Ursula started this broadcast with. You might want to plan ahead. Get yourself ready, Ursula, for what the Farmer's Almanac says will be teeth-chattering cold and plentiful snow this coming winter. The new edition of the Almanac predicts Iowa will receive a whole lot of really cold weather and snow this coming winter. But at the same time, another almanac, this one called the Old Farmer's Almanac, to distinguish itself from the Farmer's Almanac, predicts above normal temperatures in most part of the U.S. So let's put this all into context. A Penn State meteorologist says it's nearly impossible to predict weather that far ahead. In fact, in his word, the ability to predict that far ahead is zero. Let's hope, Ursula, that zero has nothing to do with any actual temperatures we're going to face. What would you rather have, zero or a lot of rain? What would you rather have? We have a choice, right?
Oh, we Iowans, we are hurt.
Well, not
yet. We are hurt by weather.
Sometimes, yes. So, but bear in mind, the odds on predicting weather, we all know the Farmer's Almanacs, there are various Farmer's Almanacs, our entertainment guides, and I've read them, you probably have too. But, you know, when they say we can predict the weather 9 months ahead, they're just pulling our legs. They can't do that. Nobody can.
You know, I was thinking about that. What's the name of the man who won the lottery twice now?
His name is West. Let me get his first. Gary West.
Gary West. So what are the chances that Gary West is going to take out another lottery ticket?
Well, I think it's pretty good because obviously he's a lucky man. But how many cars can a man get? He's going to buy a car. He won $250,000. He says he's going to buy a car. You can get a big car for $250,000 and maybe even have some left over.
Well, thank you, Dennis.
You bet.
Thank you for the news. Now, let's take a short break and
we'll be right back
soon.
Spilling over,
Ursula, that's a very nice piece of music. What is that?
It's Chris Williamson, Waterfall.
Isn't that nice on a rainy day to have waterfall? It's what we've got coming from the sky anyway. That's nice.
Yeah, Chris very Williamson nice. Was a rock and roll icon among women in the 1970s.
Very, very nice. It is 16 minutes after the hour. This is Labor Day, local talk on KHOI.
Thank you for joining us on this wet Labor Day. In honor of Labor Day, we will be speaking with Dan Homan, who is president of AFSCME, Iowa Councilor 61. Before we go on, Dennis, Labor Day is something that you know a little bit about, the history and the meaning.
Labor Day became an official holiday nationally to celebrate the labor movement in the United States, which has had a major impact on how we do business, if you will. But it came with a significant amount of struggle. Unions started forming in the 1800s after the Civil War. At that point, it was a part of the Industrial Revolution. Many Americans were working 12 or more hours a day, 7 days a week. And there were no child labor laws. Child labor abuse is widespread. You've read about many of them and heard about them in your history classes. Well, in protest, workers began organizing rallies, strikes, and boycotts. And the most significant event took place on September 5th, 1882, when about 10,000 people took an unpaid day off and marched in the streets of New York City. Well, the zenith of all these protests came back in 1894, so think about that. That's 124 years ago, when the employees of a rail car company in Chicago went on strike, protesting pay cuts and increased work hours. That strike eventually led to the city's infamous Haymarket Riot, which resulted in several deaths. Well, in the wake of all that unrest and riots across the country, Congress took action to make Labor Day a federal holiday at the urging of then-President Grover Cleveland. You might call it a governmental olive branch to the nation's labor force, to the contributions that workers made to the strength, you know, prosperity, and well-being of the country. It was called a working men's holiday. They didn't have a lot of those, and it certainly came with blood, sweat, and tears over the decades. So, as we know, the meaning of Labor Day and the meaning of every Monday holiday has changed a little bit, and now it means it's a three-day weekend full of picnics, parades, and family fun, and even, in our case, some rain on this Labor Day. Labor Day really was the product of a union movement that started in the mid-19th century in response to social and economic impacts of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of national unions emerged during the late 1800s as a major force. This was after the Civil War, and the first major union was the American Federation of Labor, which was founded in 1886 and led by Samuel Gompers until 1924. That was the first major one. And then, of course, the big one now is the American Federation of Labor Congress of Industrial Organizations, the AFL-CIO, which merged in 1955 with the AFL. The percentage of workers belonging to labor unions actually peaked back in 1954, almost 35% of the American workforce belonged to labor unions. And the total number of union members peaked back in 1979. That was 21 million people at that point in 1979 who belonged to labor unions. Now, since then, the power of unions has, and I think this is something we're going to talk certainly to Dan about, been waning a bit, particularly in the private sector. Private sector union membership has been declining in the past few years. The public sector unions have maintained their membership. So basically right now, labor unions are composed mostly of public members, public service members. We're talking about people who work for the government, people who are employed by cities, counties, et cetera, et cetera. So right now, the latest figures we have is that there are about 15 million union members in the United States right now. 11% of the labor force is or are members of unions. Now, that's down again from 35% just a generation or two ago. And a lot of folks would say that unions are not in public favor for whatever reason. We know that the government, as President Trump, for example, this past week announced that he was going to invoke his emergency authority to freeze pay for more than 2 million civilian federal workers next year. We know that teachers in several states feeling disrespected have gone on strike in recent months across the United States, most recently in Arizona and in Oklahoma. Those strikes made major news because we had thousands of people out walking picket lines in front of the state capitals in those two states, Oklahoma and Arizona, demanding that more money be put in for public education. There is a teacher strike going on right now in southwestern Washington State. Thousands of teachers there who would be teaching up to 78,000 students in southwestern Washington State have walked out. And again, what they're seeking, yes, they're seeking more money for themselves, and that's why they're out striking, but they're also seeking more money to be put into public education. It's Labor Day. We're honoring the men and women and, yes, children who have played a part in our growth as a country, because back in the 1800s, again, there were no child labor laws, and families had to have their children working in factories, working in menial jobs, long hours for no pay, and that was the genesis, partly, of the labor movement. The idea being that if we organize as a group of people as opposed to an individual, we have the strength to help get ourselves better working conditions. Without the labor union, we probably would not have had an 8-hour workday. Without a labor union, raises would probably not be made as often as they are. Unions have had a significant impact on the working conditions of Americans from the late 1800s on. We need to remember that a significant number of people, mostly again in the public sector, are members of unions. And that's not a political statement. That's just a fact of life.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and Mr. Dennis Hart, who is giving us a brief synopsis of the history of Labor Day and labor unions in the United States. And speaking of the public sector, Dan Homan has joined us by telephone from Des Moines. Mr. Homan is president of AFSCME, Iowa Council 61, which is the Iowa chapter of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Dan, welcome. Thanks for joining us. We know you have a Labor Day parade in Des Moines. There are still Labor Day parades in cities across the country, a sign that the labor union is still a powerful force in the American political system and in society. And Des Moines has an annual parade. In fact, Dan is going to be down there, and that's why we really appreciate him being on the phone this morning, because he's scheduled to be a big part of that parade. You're the president of the local AFSCME in Des Moines. We're happy to have you on the air. What's the status of the union movement right now on this Labor Day 2018 in the United States?
I believe the labor movement is coming back. I believe that recent statistics show that not only is labor unions' popularity with the general public increasing, labor unions are growing. I know here in Iowa, thanks to the Republicans in the Iowa legislature and our former governor and current acting governor, they attempted to do a death blow to public sector unions last February. But we're still standing, we're still fighting, we're still surviving, and, you know, we fully hope that this November we're going to be able to turn that tide by electing not only people who will have working men and women's interests in mind, because it's not really about the labor movement, it's about working men and women, those that are members of the labor union and those that aren't. Because everybody's affected, I believe, by some of these really insane policies that Republicans are passing all around this country and nationally.
Dan, it appears that the public sector union movement is maintaining itself, but there's been a decline in private membership, in terms of private enterprise, labor union membership. Why do you think that has been the case?
I'm probably not an expert on this, since I don't represent a lot of private sector union folks, but I believe the biggest decline is people have forgot what happened in the early years, 1900s, where people were fighting for an 8-hour workday,
right,
fighting to end child labor. And everybody out there believes that the benefits that they receive from their employer are some sort of God-given right. And I think what you're seeing across the country is folks in the public and private sector starting to realize that those people that stood before us, that fought this fight in the 1930s, the 1940s, the 1950s, if we don't continue that fight, we're going to lose those protections. You know, 8-hour workday could go away. One Republican proposed that we have underprivileged kids in our schools perform janitorial duties to pay for their free lunch and their free breakfast. I mean, what kind of craziness is this that the 1%, the very rich in this country, just can't get enough money that they're willing to do whatever they can to get more, even if that's at the detriment of everybody else in the country? And I believe that's what's going on. So there has to be a lot of re-education, and this greed starts to show its ugly head in the private sector. I think you're going to see more and more folks realizing that, you know, the only way they can survive is to unionize.
Dan, let me remind people that they're listening right now to Local Talk on KHOI Radio on this Labor Day Monday, and we're talking and pleased to be talking with Dan Homan, the president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 61 in Des Moines. Dan, that recent Supreme Court decision, you know the one I'm about to talk about, that said that essentially that workers do not have to pay for the cost of their representation. Union members do not have to pay for the cost of their representation. How bad a blow was that?
To us in Iowa, it wasn't a major blow, simply because Iowa has been a right-to-work state since 1947, and non-members have never had to pay for the representation they receive, even though we have to represent them the same as a member. But nationally, I think what we're seeing in our union is we're not seeing a lot of people dropping out of the union. Quite frankly, we're seeing people who were fee payers before becoming full-fledged members because they now realize that this is just nothing but another ploy of the ultra-rich to try and weaken the labor movement. Mark Janus, the gentleman that brought this lawsuit against AFSCME Council 31 in Illinois, now works for one of these ultra-right-wing think tanks that is probably funded by the Koch brothers who brought the lawsuit. So, you know, it's, again, the rich trying to get richer at the expense of working men and women.
Dan, one more question before we let you go on this Labor Day. What's the importance in your mind of this holiday, celebrating Labor Day? What would you like people to take away from this holiday?
What this holiday means to me is honoring those people that came before me who stood on a picket line, who fought sometimes for their very life to have dignity and respect on the job. I mean, that's really what this is about. Earlier you said that teachers were, yes, striking for money. But no, really what they're striking for is some dignity and respect on the job and to make sure that the kids that they are teaching have the resources they need to be provided a good education. It's about my dad. It's about my grandfather, who was a union member. It's about all those people that came to this country as immigrants, joined labor unions, built this country as part of the middle class. And that's who we're honoring today. I'm not honoring the Koch brothers today or other people that, millionaires and billionaires, most of them took advantage of working men and women to get that money. And it's not about unions for me. It's about the middle class. It's about working men and women, because I believe ultimately that's unions' responsibility to try to set a baseline that everybody can try to strive for. That's why I get up every day and do what I do. And that's why maybe today I'll be walking in a parade in the middle of a rainstorm. It's about those that came before us. That's what today is.
We really appreciate your spending time with us. Dan, president of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, Council 61. Have a great parade.
I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Homan, the president.
Have a happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
Together, then it starts to fly. There's a moment there.
My baby takes the morning train, Sheena Easton, and this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We are your hosts today, Ursula Rudenberg and the intrepid Mr. Dennis Hart.
We have a guest, Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, City Council person. How are you?
Hello, doing well, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in on this Labor Day. You could have been out there picnicking or doing whatever, and you're with us.
Well, it's kind of gloomy, so I'm glad to be indoors.
And you're here frequently with us, and every time it seems over the last, about 12 years, we've been talking about the rental cap ordinance, haven't we?
It does seem like that.
It seems like it. This past week, you folks passed the Rental Cap Hardship Exemption, and that's a mouthful.
Yes.
Please explain in layman's terms, and believe me, I'm a layman, how this is going to work. We know we have a 25% rental cap on seven neighborhoods around or near Iowa State University. 25% can be rentals of those homes, single-family homes. What's this hardship exemption? How's it going to work?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are two parts to it. One is the hardship part, which would deal with a circumstance where a person owns a home in these areas and has been trying to sell that home to no avail. they have to meet certain criteria in order to qualify for the hardship exemption, we'll call it, where, you know, they have to have had their property on the market for a certain amount of time. They have to have not gotten any offers, basically. And they have to have rentals surrounding them in order to qualify for the hardship. And then we have the one-time exception part of the exception rule. So the hardship thing is one category. And then there's this whole other category of folks now who will have basically one last chance to get a letter of compliance, a rental permit. We call them letters of compliance. So they'll have one last chance to apply for a letter of compliance, and then they'll have to bring their property up to rental code and be using that letter of compliance to actually rent their property within a year in order to keep it. Otherwise, that letter of compliance or that rental permit will go away if they're not actually using their property as a rental. And that letter of compliance is not transferable if they sell their property. So that's only meant to give folks who are currently homeowners in those properties. It'll give them a chance to get a rental permit, but they can't use that rental permit to drive up the value of their home because it doesn't go with the sale.
Now, this is incredibly complex.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure anybody outside you folks at the city understand this.
Yes.
And I know I have sat through this for a lot of meetings. But I have a basic question. You have an exception now, which I don't quite understand, but people can find out by calling the city.
Yes,
okay.
That's true. Yep.
They can find that out. But when you have a rental cap and you're trying to get those rentals down to 25%, and now you have exceptions, which means you can go above.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's 25%, you can have an exception. How is that going to play out in terms of actually making that rental cap work?
Good question. I think time will tell. We don't exactly know yet, but a few thoughts on that. One is to get the exceptions or the hardship, either way, it is kind of a high bar. It's quite a lot of work for people and money right up front to get a letter of compliance and to make sure that their home is fit for the rental code. That could be an investment both of time and money for them, and they have to be renting it within a year. So my feeling is that the number of rental permits we'll see spawned by this exception process hopefully won't be as many as the folks in the neighborhood are fearing it might be, just because it is kind of a high bar. And then the other part is we've got to start to work too on some programs or ideas or ways maybe to incentivize home ownership. So either reconverting converted rental places back into owner-occupied or things like that. So that'll be another piece, I think, to start to bring this percentage down.
Talk about the almost impossible task that I think you had as a council in this whole rental code or this rental cap thing. The state, of course, did away with Ames's previous rental code. That's mm-hmm. why you had to go through this dance for the last year and a half. But you're being torn between private homeowners who want to be able to do what they want
mm-hmm.
with their properties.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you have people in those neighborhoods who have formed neighborhood groups who say, look what's happened to our neighborhood over the last years.
Mm-hmm.
We've gone from a few rentals to majority rentals in some cases. How do you walk that line? You're going to hurt everybody, but how do you walk it?
Yes, exactly. Boy, this has been an exercise in compromise, that's for sure.
Yes.
The rental cap itself, you know, was a win for the folks in the neighborhoods.
It was.
Who are hoping to slow the tide of rentals. And then we went back and forth with exceptions. That was a compromise for folks who are homeowners, and but some of the way we crafted the exceptions and not allowing those rental permits to be transferable upon sale, you know, that was a compromise back the other way. And so it was really, yeah, it was back and forth with compromise until we finally landed on middle ground, which, as you alluded to, is going to upset both groups.
I mean,
sometimes compromise you know, it's people both win, but they also both lose. And so I think you can't please everyone all the time. And this is hopefully as close as we can get to a middle fair road.
In your heart of hearts, I'm not even sure what that phrase means, but you know what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. Do you believe that this rental cap actually can help reduce the number of rentals in those seven neighborhoods? Not now, but over time. Will it actually have that impact?
I think it will. I think we've seen it already. So before we got these exceptions into place, you know, properties have been for sale in those neighborhoods, and they've been selling as owner-occupied homes. So I think that we've seen that there's a market for people who want to live, you know, want to purchase a home in these areas to live in. And I think we'll continue to see that market. I mean, one of the biggest complaints or challenges we hear to people who want to live in Ames is affordable housing, and the homes in these areas, for the most part, are quite affordable compared to new construction or things like that. So I think the market will be there. I think as homes turn over, people who were worried maybe that they wouldn't be able to sell their home without a rental permit, I think they'll find that the market is there. So I think we've already seen it start to work. And I imagine that will just continue.
Let's hope that works. You've put in a lot of time and effort, the council, the mayor, city manager. This has been a mess for a year and a half. Let's hope this one works.
Yes, thank you. I do hope it does.
We have a lot to talk about. Moving on to the Campus Town Self-Supporting Municipal Improvement District. That one went down.
Yes, yeah. By no fault of councils or no action of councils,
correct.
We were supportive of that. But the Campus Town area did get what they call a petition of remonstrance, which it stops the SMID in its tracks and renders it null. And that was basically the way that works is to get a SMID going, you need to get, you only need to get 25% of property owners' signatures to propose one. Campus Town had gotten about 40% of approval from property owners in the area, but you only need 40% to kill it, too. And that's what the petition of remonstrance had, was a little over 40% of property owners.
And let's bring closer to home what this would have meant. That particular proposal would have provided for a tax on some businesses mm-hmm. to raise more money for improvement of Campus Town. There are some business owners quoted in the paper saying a lot of folks around Ames don't want to go to Campus Town because they think it's dirty and all of this. Mm-hmm. That was an effort to clean things up there.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, the SMID is, yeah, it's a mechanism where you assess a property tax on businesses or on properties in the district, and that money would have gone towards things like snow removal, street cleaning, you know, power washing, or it could have also gone to marketing the area, actually, branding or marketing of the Campus Town area. But I think the biggest needs that the CAA identified were, yes, snow removal and trash pickup and cleaning to make the area safe and welcoming.
Is it your impression, and I was somewhat surprised by that business owner quoted in the paper as saying a lot of folks think it's dirt, is it your impression that is a feeling around Ames, that Campus Town is a place to be avoided? I'm talking about the non-Campus Town residents, obviously.
Yeah, that's a good question. I do hear, you know, that I do hear from some people that they don't go to Campus Town. I'm not sure if it's a function of the variety of businesses that are there. I mean, the retail is somewhat limited. It's mostly
students.
Yeah, exactly, and mostly nightlife in terms of businesses in the area. So, you know, that's probably partially it, too. But, you know, I've been there, and, you know, things like snow removal and trash pickup. Snow removal in the area is is an issue. You know, I've been to Campus Town in the middle of winter, and people trot on those sidewalks. It becomes very icy, and certain businesses do a great job of keeping their area clean, and then others not so much. So I can see how people with mobility issues are certainly going to avoid that area. Yeah. You know, maybe elderly people who, you know, it's just not safe in the winter. You know, and then in the summer too, that, you know, is probably more the cleanliness issue. But.
And there are some parking problems there. There's no question about that because of the students. It's not to be negative on students, but it's just crowded there.
Yep.
Very crowded.
Yep.
Speaking of parking, we'll move downtown. And you and I have talked about this before. Yeah, we segue on this broadcast very easily. I keep hearing from Main Street businesses, and I spend a lot of time at a certain coffee shop downtown, so I'm talking to some people all the time. Some business owners are upset by the increased parking rates because they insist they're losing business because people are either having to pay too much and they don't want to pay it, or there are other problems. Have you been hearing this since those parking rates went up with the meters?
Oh, yes. Yes, we've been hearing that.
A lot of it.
Yeah. I would say both from downtown business owners and then just citizens who are, you know, experiencing sticker shock.
Where do we go from here then if you're hearing a lot of complaints?
Yeah, good question. We'll look at it again. But, I mean, our parking meter fees, they're not designed to make money, right? They're designed to break even with the costs of the parking system. And so the estimates that we base the new rate on were all based on cost. And so it's interesting when people say, oh, you know, we shouldn't have raised it as much, et cetera. It's like, well, that money does need to come from somewhere. And if it doesn't come from parking fees itself, then, you know, then what are we dipping into our sales tax money for that? Are we dipping into property tax money for that? No one likes to see property tax increases either. So it's interesting that, you know, the system is not designed to be bringing in a profit. It's only designed to break even. My response to people is it is, I think, somewhat unfortunate that we didn't raise the rates more gradually over time. It had been 24 years, I think, since the last increase, and that is probably too long to go. We could have done slight increases over time, and it would have felt like less to people.
So here's the balancing act again that I want to ask you about. You need to raise the money to pay for existing structures, but you don't want to hurt those downtown businesses. It's in the city's great interest to keep Main Street vital.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance that?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, we definitely will be looking more at parking. We actually already had a downtown parking study in the works. It still is in the works, and the traffic engineer is working on what that might look like, the parking and traffic study. So I think we'll keep looking at it. I think we'll keep things as they are for now, at least. You know, the decision was made last November to raise the rates, and then, of course, it doesn't kick in till July, and
right.
So there's always that delay.
What does the money actually pay for?
It would pay for things like repairs to the meters themselves or upgrades to the meters, staffing of people who are compliance officers in that, repairing parking lots themselves. So the city owns a number of parking lots, and as time goes on, those need repairs. And now with our stormwater ordinances being tighter, when the city repairs its own parking lot, we have to make changes too for stormwater, and that can be expensive. So the City Hall parking lot would be a good example of one where they recently redid it, put in a lot of stormwater features to meet our own code compliance, of course, and that just costs more money. So those would be the big factors. So equipment maintenance and repair, staffing, and then the actual infrastructure of the parking lots itself.
Some of the Main Street business owners have even proposed that you do away with meters. Nevada has no meters downtown. Of course, one of the problems there is once you do away with the meters, people can then park on Main Street and never have to move their cars. And that might hurt business as well, because you have maybe employees or people who want to spend 6 hours in one place,
mm-hmm.
keeping somebody else from parking in front of a store who might be a customer. So again, you have to balance that one.
Yep. That is a balancing act. And I think that's why meters were originally installed or are originally installed in places, is to guarantee turnover
right.
of customers. And so, you know, we have heard that suggestion. I don't know if we'd notice that effect if we were to do something like that. But my guess is that it wouldn't be quite so simple as folks think to take them away.
Do you think you're going to revisit this anytime soon?
Well, we'll wait to see about the parking study, you know, sending out a request for proposals from a consultant on that. That'll be upcoming yet in the fall. So,
Lincoln Way rezoning. Is there an update on the Chicago developer who came out with some preliminary ideas to put in a major mixed-use development along Lincoln Way? Any updates on that?
I haven't heard anything since we originally heard of that proposal. But no, I haven't seen any proposals back with modifications yet.
That would be a major change, not just in the look, but in the ambiance of downtown, because now you're talking hundreds of people living in a complex along Lincoln Way between Duff and Grand Avenues. And there would be retail on the ground floor, as we heard from the earlier one, which might have an impact on, again, Main Street businesses. It's that balancing act.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I'd be curious if we see anything or what the timeline is there. Yeah, like I said, we haven't had any updates lately, so just kind of in a holding pattern to see if we hear from them on that one.
What's the status of Grand Avenue and the extension proposal to push Grand south of South 4th Street?
Yep, that is going, but slowly. Most of the delays we've had there, or I don't even know if they're delays, but the time it's taken on that has been securing the property. So we have to purchase or otherwise obtain the property that Grand will sit on. And for some landowners, they've been willing to negotiate, and some are asking more than market value, and so we have to negotiate, you know, and see what we can do there. But some are just refusing to negotiate at all, and that means that we have to go a different route.
That means that we have to whisper those unspeakable words, eminent domain, and I know you don't want to do that.
Exactly. Neither one of them are four letters long, but it sure seems like it.
It seems like it to the owners. Eminent domain, of course, was the threat down in Des Moines when Hubble Realty wanted to put their condominium complex on Locust Street, and the federal government said, no, we want that. And that was going to be an issue because the government supersedes private industry on that. So do you think you may have to use it?
I think it's a possibility. I mean, if people refuse to negotiate at all, there's only so much we can do to try to talk them into negotiating. But we need to get that road through. I mean, the extension of Grand has been in the CIP for years. It's very important to many people. You know, very important to traffic flows on South Duff. So we get the impression from the community we need to proceed with that. And so we're limited then in what we can do.
Well, now I'm a bit surprised. What time of day did you see traffic actually flowing on South Duff? I see it stopped mostly. But
exactly.
Especially on a Friday afternoon.
Flowing like molasses. Yeah, exactly.
What's the latest on the Healthy Life Center?
Oh, well, let's see. You might have heard that Jan and George Barron gave a gift
to $1 million.
Yeah, $1 million to the Heartland Senior Services, and that was for their contribution to the Healthy Life Center. So that was a very generous gift from them, and I think that was the last we've heard. We'll be having a meeting on that coming up this fall yet, too, to find out kind of where we are, where the fundraising is at, and how to proceed on that. So we'll get an update I think here in the next month or two.
I'm hearing some rumblings again around town, just those parts of town that I go to, you know, those crazy parts of town. Some people are saying maybe it's too big, too much money for this Healthy Life Center. Have you heard that?
That thought had occurred to me. It is a very ambitious project. It's a really neat one and would be a one-of-a-kind project for Ames. So, I mean, I hope we can do it. I think if we find that the price tag is too high, I'm sure we'll go back and look and see what we can do, you know, but really we want to aim for the stars, in the sense that this would be a really state-of-the-art facility. It'd be great for Ames. So we're hoping that we can proceed with the plan as it is.
What have I not asked you about today?
Oh, good question.
Or have we covered all of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think I'm trying to see if there's any other good tidbits in my notes. The rental cap really has been the bulk of what we've been talking about. So having that done and off our plates is really exciting, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be very strange going to the next city council meeting and not hearing something about an exception, a rental cap, neighborhood groups. Very strange. I don't know if I'll be able to orient myself.
Yeah, it'll be an alien landscape there.
Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, as always.
I had something I wanted to ask real quick. Bronwyn, as you know, the 8th of September is being designated as a climate day, and the emphasis is on actions by local governments. Is the Ames City Council taking note of this day at all, or making any proclamations, or in some ways acknowledging the local role of, addressing the environment?
Oh, good question. Not that I've heard of off the top of my head, but it's something we talk about in general, when we're making decisions. But I don't know about on the 8th itself. Mm-hmm. Any special proclamations that day? Maybe at the next council meeting we might do one in retrospect.
And for our public, when is the next council meeting?
The second Tuesday of September. So that'd be what, the 11th?
Yeah. September 11th.
At 6 p.m. Council chambers.
I'll see you there.
Sounds good.
Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, Ames City Council person. Thank you again for joining us on this Labor Day.
Oh, happy to. Thank you.
And we have all been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And we've been your hosts. I'm Dennis Hart, so you must be
Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening.
Local Talk engineered today by Aladdin, and beautifully so. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m. noon and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. And remember, you can also hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI, streaming live online at khoifm.org.
Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You also heard Waterfall by Chris Williamson. And My Baby Takes the Morning Train, Sheena Easton. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, Mr. Dennis Hart will train you.
I will.
Yeah. So come and join the Local Talk team if you're interested in learning a little bit about reporting.
You bet. It's actually fun. Please remember, you, the listener, you're what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Not us, it's you. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again
on the radio,
I hope.
Tomorrow morning, we will air the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing for the new Supreme Court seat starting at 8 a.m., so it's going to be a little bit of a different day tomorrow on KHOI. The hearings go for 3 days. We'll see how long we want to air them live, but we will start tomorrow morning with the Senate Judiciary hearings.